It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll get a check-in from WPR reporter Mike Simonson about the legality of a tribal harvest camp in northern Wisconsin. It's part of the protest effort against a proposed iron mine.
Also, the Emmy nominations are out, and for the first time ever, shows you can only see online made the cut. We'll find out how that's shaking things up when it comes to the way that we watch TV.
But first, we did a program a few weeks ago on getting your kids outside. And after the program, we heard from a listener who recommended geocaching as a fun way to get their kids out.
And we wanted to follow up on that and learn more about geocaching. So joining us now is Jim Bliefnick, president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. And Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to discuss it with you.
So for people who haven't heard of geocaching, describe it for us.
Well, basically, geocaching is an outdoor treasure hunting game using a GPS-enabled device, whether it be a handheld GPS or a smartphone. The participants navigate to a specific set of coordinates, and they attempt to find what's called a geocache, which is a container that is hidden at that location.
Now, who hid it there? Santa or someone else?
Another geocacher usually hides it.
Okay.
A lot of times after somebody finds, we like to say, around 100 geocaches, go out and hide a few. Now that you know what you're doing, go out and give something back to the geocaching community and return the favor.
Do you have to dig for it? Is it underground or is it just
sitting? No, there are a few rules, and the geocaches cannot be buried. So it's not like digging for treasure, because we don't want anything destroyed out in Mother Nature's backyard.
Gotcha.
So if I want to go out and go geocaching and I've got a fancy GPS device or a smartphone with GPS, how do I find out where a cache is?
Well, Rob, what you would do is you would actually go to the internet and just probably Google geocaching, and you'll get to the geocaching.com website. The first thing you would need to do is to set up a basic membership, which does not cost anything. Once you're done doing that, you would go to the menu and visit Hide and Seek a Cache. After that, you would find the zip code box, enter in your own zip code, and click Search. Now, the default rating on search is usually 100 miles. You'd probably want to knock one zero off and see how many geocaches are hidden within a 10-mile radius of your zip code. And you'd probably be surprised. There could be several hundred, or there might be one just maybe a few hundred feet down the street from where you live.
Now, if I go out there with my kids, they're going to want to know what kind of treasures are out there. Can you give me a sense of the kinds of things that people store away for these caches?
Throw away. Well, that's interesting. Well, we call it swag.
Swag. You
know, it's things. It could be anywhere from what we call McToys. It could be bottle caps. I found some very nice things, keychains. I actually got a very nice flashlight I've been using for 4 years. Usually it depends on the difficulty of the cache. If it took you a lot of effort to find it, there's usually some pretty good stuff in there. But the rule is, if you take something out, you need to put something in that you brought along of equal or greater value, so that the cache contents don't get depleted.
Tell us about one or two of your favorite experiences geocaching here in Wisconsin.
Oh, that's my favorite question that a lot of people ask me, Rob. And I think usually they say, what is your favorite geocache? Oh, I think it was maybe 4 years ago in late November during deer hunting season. I went out to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, and there was a geocache out there that you had to go to 8 different sets of coordinates before you could find the final. And it took you down the side of a bluff and along a river and up another bluff to what they called Lover's Leap. And what made it interesting was I was racing a snowstorm, and I had to get that done before the snowstorm hit. And just as I got done and was heading back to my car, it took 3 hours, but the snow was just starting to fall. But that was one of the most interesting experiences that I had in the almost six years that I've been geocaching.
Wow, that sounds like such a cool experience. And, you know, for someone like me who's definitely a geocaching neophyte, can you give us a little history lesson on how this got started? It seems like such a quirky thing to do.
Yeah, well, Veronica, back in May of 2000, the United States government officially removed what's called selective availability from the Global Positioning System satellites. They were mainly used for military service back then. There are 26 satellites that orbit the Earth. 24 are used all the time, and they have 2 spares in case one breaks down, like a spare tire. So what this meant was that civilian GPS units now possess greater accuracy than previously permitted. So that was back in May of 2000. So the next, I think it was May 3rd, on May 4th, there was a gentleman by the name of Dave Ulmer out in Oregon, He put a container out in the woods in Oregon. He posted the numbers on a GPS user group site, and he actually had two finders in the first 3 days. He basically just said, hey, I put something here. Grab a GPS and go find it. And it pretty much took off from there. Later that year, it ended up, there were some internet people got involved with it, and it's headquartered now, it's an entity called Groundspeak, and it's out in Seattle, Washington. So they have all the big computers sitting there with staying cooled down, and so basically this is a worldwide phenomenon that's been going on now for almost 13 years.
We've got a comment from a geocacher, Kim, in Facebook, who writes, it's fun, educational, and a great way to spend time with your family. Is this pretty commonly a family activity?
It can be, yes. I have my son and grandson. We go out together geocaching, so we're three generations. Sometimes there's husband and wife teams that go out together. But what I found is it's a great way for families to combine technology, which kids are a little more up on that than I probably was 40, 50 years ago, and they combine that technology with getting outdoors and using that technology to get some exercise, take a hike in the woods, see some amazing places that you wouldn't normally see if some individual hadn't placed a geocache there just for your own entertainment.
And we've got a comment, another one here. This is from John on Facebook. He says, my wife and I love geocaching. It's an awesome way to get out and see places in your area that you would never find on your own. And so, Jim, have you ever found yourself in a really cool place and you thought, wow, I would not be here if it weren't for geocaching?
Most definitely. And as a matter of fact, once you find that place, you kind of like to share it with other people. So you might find a place and say, hey, there's no geocache here, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to hide one nearby so people can experience this spot. Another geocaching thing that we do, we have what's called event caches. It's just a gathering of people. It could be at a bowling alley. It could be at a restaurant. Last Saturday, I held an event cache at a state natural area over by Baraboo, and the people that attended were just amazed at what they saw there with the waterfalls and this grotto. I'm sorry, people in Baraboo, but your secret's getting out there.
So that's what you did last weekend. Do you have plans in mind for your next geocaching expedition?
Oh, not really. It's kind of it's something you can do in your spare time. This time of year, I don't have much spare time, but with work and a few other obligations I have. So summers can be pretty busy. There's a little less geocaching, but it's done year-round. There are some geocaches that are hidden in cattail marshes that you can only get to in the dead of winter when the ice is frozen.
Hmm.
So it's not something, you know, sometimes you can devote a whole day to it. People do what's called power caching. And other times I do some work appointments. Maybe I'll just grab a cache while I'm driving by on the road because it's just what we call a park and grab, you know, a very easy one. So when you look at the geocache page itself, right, it has what's called a difficulty and a terrain rating. It's a 1 through 5 star. Difficulty means how hard it is to find the cache. The terrain is how difficult the terrain is that you might have to go up. A 5-star would be you may have to scuba dive to get it or
wow.
Use ropes to climb a mountain. So I don't do too many 5-star caches. But, you know, the cache pages are very interactive. There are a lot of different avenues. Being the president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association, our local statewide organization has several side games ourselves. We have what's called Cache Rescue, make sure containers aren't left out in the woods and nobody picks them up. We also have what's called a lonely cache game. We want to know why some caches haven't been found in 6 to 9 months. Are they missing, or is it just a difficult cache to find? So we have a little contest and a little party every year to reward the people that went out and kept the quality of our cache hides up in the state of Wisconsin.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today and introducing us to geocaching.
You're very welcome, Rob.
That was Jim Bliefnik, president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. There's a lot more to cover about geocaching if you want to learn about it, more about it, and especially how to involve kids. Larry Mueller is going to talk with people from the Wisconsin Geocaching Association coming up Monday at 11, and you can call in with your questions and comments then, too. It's Monday at 11 with Larry.
And coming up next, we'll check in with WPR's Mike Simonson about the status of a harvest camp in northern Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about how Netflix is shaking up our TV habits. But first, WPR reporter Mike Simonson is on the line with some of the latest news in the ongoing mining protests in northern Wisconsin. And Mike, thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome.
So we've been hearing from you about this harvest camp up in Ashland County, which has also been functioning as sort of a de facto protest site. What's going on with this harvest camp?
Well, it isn't a protest site, although they're against the mine itself, but they're not allowing any protests on site of this five-acre camp. What it is, it's a place where they can inventory plants. They harvest naturally growing plants. The first time I visited there, and I've been there twice, I was given a leek. No, I think it's a reek. But it's a little onion. It's oniony and garlicky. It stayed with me for about an hour. But you know what they do is they harvest bark for birch bark canoes. They have a communal tent for food. They don't remove any trees. They're not planting any vegetation. They're keeping it as natural as they can. You know, creeks run through it and such. So it's a place that has not only education to teach about the plants and the use of these plants through Native American custom, but also what it means to Native American people, past and present.
So it's really functioning as a nature education site, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is, and it is very unusual. Harvest camps go back hundreds of years in Native culture, but this is the first one that's been established in northern Wisconsin, at least in modern history. And so this is the first time it's had to try to go through the Iron County Board, for instance, and this is what the legality thing, the hang-up that we're seeing emerge in the past couple of weeks.
So tell us about the latest news on the legality of the camp.
Well, you don't have an hour, and I don't really... I have talked literally to three attorneys, several public officials. This is one of those stories that reporters call the 10-foot pole stories. People aren't happy when they hear you call them and you're a reporter asking about this issue because it is very controversial. The Forestry Department in Iron County isn't even calling me back, but the issue is the Couderay governing body passed and authorized this harvest camp. They did that in May. And then the Forestry Committee of Iron County unanimously approved it, giving them a one-year land use permit, which is the first time they've ever done that. And it seemed to be non-controversial. But then there was this two-month black hole of information and nothing happening. A permit was never actually granted to LCO or to this harvest camp. So now some people are coming forward challenging it, like the Wisconsin County Forest Association, saying they're there illegally. The state of Wisconsin, the DNR, says, yes, they do not have a permit, and as long as they don't have a permit, they are not. It is not lawful. Yet, they don't want to touch this one either. And Iron County is, next week the Forestry Committee's put it back on their agenda, so I guess we're going to see what will happen with it there.
Any idea, Mike, what tribal organizers have to say about why the permit didn't go through?
They think it's politics. They think it's they initially got full support of this committee, and then it never was put on the agenda of the full county board. Something happened there. And so what happened, I'm not sure, and a lot of people don't want to talk about it. But the legality is, apparently, although this is a gray area, the full county board has to pass this, or that camp's not legal. Now, the tribe contends that with treaty rights, tribal members have the right to hunt, fish, and gather. And so they may not need the full county board. What they're trying to do, though, is get along with Iron County.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, for updating us. And we're going to check back in with you as the story keeps on developing, like it sounds like it's going to be doing.
You know, if I could just say this might be a barometer, though, of the chance that this mine is going to be built. Because if Iron County goes back on what its committee has recommended, then it will probably go like Ashland County and pass a real tough ordinance on making the mining company pay money for reclamation, for fees, and for costs to the county, which the mining company says if that happens, they may just pull up stakes and leave.
Oh, so this could be it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks so much. We'll be watching it and checking back in with you. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
That was WPR reporter Mike Simonson.
This is the memo I've drafted on our Middle East policy we've been developing. I'd like to coin the phrase trickle-down diplomacy.
Frank, that way, we are not nominating you for Secretary of State. I know he made you a promise, but circumstances have changed.
The nature of promises, Linda, is that they remain immune to changing circumstances.
That was a clip from the Netflix program House of Cards. This morning, Emmy nominations were announced, and Netflix is making history. This is the first time the Emmys have acknowledged shows distributed online.
House of Cards, the political intrigue saga that we just heard a clip from, are 9 nominations. Arrested Development scored 3.
So that got us wondering, how is the way we're watching TV changing? And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Have you switched to Netflix? Are there still shows on broadcast TV you watch each and every week? Do you rent DVDs or get them out of the library? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. With us to talk about the changing face of TV is Willa Paskin. She's TV critic for Slate.com. Willa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, some critics are calling these nominations for House of Cards and also Arrested Development on Netflix a historic change. Is it really that big a deal in TV land?
I think yes and no. You know, they are the first broadband-only shows to be nominated, so that's a big deal. But the Emmy board had sort of changed the rules allowing broadband shows to be nominated in 2007, so they've been sort of expecting this to happen. And, you know, Amazon and Apple and HBO even, a lot of people are making shows that are only on the internet, Hulu. So theoretically, other shows will follow in Netflix's footsteps. But certainly it's a big deal. It's the first time it's ever happened. And it's, you know, it's interesting to see that Emmy voters were not at all turned off by the fact that it's just on Netflix and that they were willing to sort of embrace those kind of shows.
Well, another thing that was interesting, no nominations for the big four networks in the dramatic series category, which is one of the more prestigious ones, HBO, other cable networks, and Netflix swept the nominations there. Is this, this has got to be leading some gnashing of teeth at the networks, isn't it?
Well, I think they're sort of used to getting served by premium cable at this point. You know, last year they were not nominated in the big drama categories either. They are always well represented in the comedy categories. I mean, HBO had something like 108 nominations this year, which was maybe double what ABC and CBS and NBC, which all had around something like 52, had. You know, this is HBO sort of makes, and AMC and FX and all these sort of networks are making these very beautiful, serious, you know, highbrow shows, relatively speaking. And that's not kind of what the networks do. I'm sure that they are not tickled that they're never in the best drama category, but I'm also sure they're not super surprised.
Well, this is the Emmys, but is this a bigger sign that TV as we know it is changing?
You mean because it's moving away from the network?
Yeah.
I mean, certainly that's true. And anyone who watches TV, I mean, compared to 10 or 15 years ago, there's just so many more places you can watch it. There's so many more channels that are doing interesting things. I mean, there's a lot of channels that aren't doing interesting things, but there's just a lot more channels. So certainly that's the trend, and that's the way that it's been going, and that's the way that it will continue to go. I mean, you know, the networks are increasingly in not great shape. CBS as well. NBC has had all these, you know, sort of well-documented troubles. You know, if they can make good shows that people really like, then they'll sort of stem the tide of, you know, kind of losing buzz all the time to all these other cable networks. But, you know, they have to kind of come up with the shows.
Are these big buzz shows on Netflix, on HBO, and elsewhere changing the way the networks design programs? Are they trying to join the arms race here?
I think that they are a little bit. I mean, you know, the issue for them is obviously there's things that you can't do on network television that you can do on cable, and especially on premium cable, that don't actually even necessarily make your show better, but certainly do indicate to viewers that you're more serious. You know, a certain amount of sex, a certain amount of violence, a certain amount of explicit material, cursing, really dark themes that, you know, you just can't put on if you're, you know, 9 o'clock on NBC. I mean, but that said, you know, you've seen, so, for example, The Walking Dead, which is AMC's zombie show, which didn't get any nominations, but is basically the highest rated show on television in the demographic that audiences care about, you know, it's extremely graphic. There's always disgusting zombies with their body parts hanging off, you know, and audiences obviously love it. And you've seen sort of on the networks, them sort of trying to make shows that seem as, you know, risque and adult. So there's a show, Hannibal, which is on NBC, which is about Hannibal Lecter. And it's very, you know, it's very beautiful, but very graphic show about a serial killer. You know, there's The Following on Fox, which is the Kevin Bacon show, which is again about a very graphic, disturbing show about, you know, a mastermind serial killer. You know, so they're trying to sort of get into some of this thematic territory, but they still can't have naked people. They still can't have cursing. You know, there's still things that they can't do.
We're talking to Willa Paskin. She's TV critic for Slate.com. And we're talking about how television is changing, partly prompted by this morning's Emmy nominations. We've been talking about the network side. Now we're going to turn it around and get the people on the other side of the screen, the people viewing it. And we want to hear from you. How do you watch TV? Are you a binge watcher? Do you, on Netflix or on DVDs, watch episodes all at once? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. There's more to come. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about how television is changing, in part because of this morning's Emmy nominations, the first time shows from an online distributor, Netflix, have been nominated.
And we want to know what you think. Have you changed how you watch TV? Are you watching more streaming online? Are you watching appointment television like we used to do? And how has it changed your experience? We'd love to know what you think. 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Willa Paskin is with us. She's TV critic for Slate.com. We'll go straight to the phones now. We have Chris with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and kind of throw in my two cents that I've absolutely changed kind of my TV watching habits since, I mean, it started with DVR, but then the internet just took the convenience of DVR and then said, it's pretty much DVR, only anywhere you need to be. I don't even actually have cable anymore. I pay for the premium services like Hulu Plus and the like.
Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. And Willa, he is not alone, right? This is a growing trend where people aren't watching TV, really. They're watching computer.
Yeah, I mean, the networks are... And actually, the cable writers, too, are worried about this phenomenon, which is called cord cutting, you know, where you basically get all of your TV over the internet. It's increasing, especially among young people, obviously. But Americans really like their television, so it's not like they're watching less television. And especially if you are getting it through the internet, you know, most people, the cable provider and the internet provider are the same. So it's not like they're losing the money that way. Mm-hmm. So it's not like quite as terrible and horrible and no good for the actual companies as if, you know, we were all stealing our television, for example. But it's definitely, most people obviously are doing a little bit of that. You know, they DVR or they watch something that they missed, you know, on the internet.
And whether we're talking about DVR or streaming or watching on DVD, we've seen the rise of binge watching, which I've certainly done more than I care to admit. Talk about how binge watching is changing the way we watch TV.
Well, I mean, it means you can have it all as soon as you want it. And the thing that's interesting about binge-watching is I think that because the shows that have been most infamously binge-watched are basically very good, you know, a lot of people have, say, binge-watched all of Breaking Bad before a new season, or binge-watched Mad Men, or binge-watched The Wire, or some of these shows that, you know, are really great television shows. It's become this sort of, like, rarefied activity, you know, like you'd only binge watch something really good, but everyone has had the experience of like sitting on the couch, you turn the TV on, and then you don't turn it off, and you watched, you know, six episodes of like porn, like Pawn Stars, or six episodes of The Real World, or six episodes of whatever happened to be on. So the idea that you just keep watching if you can, I mean, we're all really familiar with that. So now it's just they've made, you know, Netflix in particular, or if you're watching on Hulu, or if you're watching on your DVR, you know, you can just watch another one right away. And I think the thing about that changes that about the viewing experience is, you know, you are paying a little bit less attention to each episode, you know, you just get the next one right away. Mm-hmm. So if you like it enough to continue, you're going to watch them all. But if you're watching them week to week, you might notice things that were annoying about it, maybe, that you won't notice if you're going in such a rush.
But also it's easier to follow. You don't have to start this week's episode thinking, wait, who's that guy and why is he important? Because you just saw it. It's easier to follow the flow, it seems like, when you watch him back to back like that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the arguments has been, you know, that Netflix has made, it's sort of you can have increased complexity because you don't write. Everyone is really like following along. But I haven't quite noticed that that has been the case. You know, I don't, like, there's no scenes from when you turn on the episode. It's not like last week on House of Cards. Mm-hmm. Into it. But, you know, the really complicated shows, the shows like The Wire, for example, wasn't, like, holding back just because it was on TV in a certain way. You know, we'll see. There's all these playful things that people could do. They could maybe get really more complicated, but they haven't quite yet.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Valerie in Lake Geneva. Hi, Valerie.
Hi there. I am a cord cutter and a binge watcher.
Sounds like a support group.
Yeah. You know, I finally made the decision about 2 months ago to cut our cable. I have young children as well. And a couple of things. I find that we are more selective about the TV that we watch because we're streaming the things that we are looking for as opposed to just randomly having it on in the background. And that's refreshing. I bought a Roku box, and so I stream Netflix, Hulu, and those sort of things. But a question for Willa. I'm a little bit anxious about October coming up and not having access to The Walking Dead. And I'm wondering if you see or the possibility of this emergence of kind of a la carte streaming where we may be able to stream HBO, Showtime, AMC without having a cable TV provider, just internet access.
Oh, interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, that's been sort of a fantasy and a wish of TV watchers for a long time, because obviously that would be great, you know. But HBO, for example, with their HBO Go, seems extremely disinterested in providing that for people. So it may happen eventually in a couple of years or something, but it is not at all of interest to them right now. You know, HBO Go, you really have to have HBO on your television. When you sign up for HBO Go, you sign up through your cable provider to prove that you have actually HBO on your television. It's just the priority of the networks, all of them at this point. You know, they don't want you to be a cord cutter yet, basically. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the cost of stuff might tip over where it's worth it to them because they're making enough money, enough revenue off of the streaming stuff for it to work. But it's not here yet. So I'm sorry for your Walking Dead habits. But I think you'll be able to find it probably, you know, soon after the season finishes.
Good luck, Valerie. We have Marcus in Nakusa on the line now. Hi, Marcus.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Wanted to make the point that the streaming services, it's getting closer to the a la carte type thing. My wife and I, we've cut the cable/dish bill, if you would say, and we've just gone with the internet, per se. And the nicest thing about it is we have a daughter, and you can pick and choose what programs, when you want to show them to her, and she just loves it. And it's something that we've taken advantage of, and I would see more people going to it.
And no commercials, too.
No commercials, too, and it's just great. And I know Amazon Plus, I think it is, they also, for a cost, you can buy new episodes of TV shows that are aired. The only downside to streaming like we do, you don't get the sports. And I know that's one big thing, but that's what friends are for. And another thing, I forgot what I was going to say, but yeah, it's. I think it's going to be more of the way of the future, I would say.
Gotcha.
People the a la carte way.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. More a la carte coming, Willa?
I mean, certainly it's true that more people are going to be watching television through the internet, through Roku's, you know, not having cable in a sort of regular way. I mean, the a la carte thing means something a little bit more specific than that, which is that, you know, either we would be able to pick our cable channels altogether. So instead of getting this package from, you know, whatever your cable provider is, it's these 200 channels, you could just say, like, I want these five and I'll pay, you know, $3 for each, which they are not interested in doing. Or that, you know, you'd be able to split your getting a streaming service from an existing network and not having it on your television. And I think both of those things are not happening anytime soon.
Before we let you go, I wanted to talk to you briefly about something you wrote about how Netflix is selling us TV shows and putting together shows like House of Cards based on their research and marketing it to us based on the other things we watched. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody who has Netflix, you know when you go on, you get all these recommended series. You know, they sort of will be like, this will be good for you, Willa. But that's based on sort of what you've watched in the past.
So they have some idea of what the shows that they're making, what kind of show it is. So House of Cards is a political drama. You know, someone who had maybe watched, you know, a bunch of thrillers about politics, or had watched, you know, some other, had watched serious television shows on Netflix before, they might think that that was of particular interest to that viewer. And so then they push it to those, you know, those viewers in different ways. So, for example, like when they were trying to advertise Netflix, they were trying to advertise House of Cards to me, they advertised it with Kate Mara's character, who's a young female blogger on the show, because they know that I like romantic comedies, for example. But somebody who hadn't watched as many romantic comedies on Netflix as I had got Kevin Spacey, and it was sort of marketed as a more political show. So they're trying, you know, they know about what we like, and so they have some more confidence about how to make us like the thing that they're making. But that said, you know, it has to be good. So, like, you know, House of Cards is pretty good. Orange is the New Black, which is their new show, is really great. And so people are really, you know, once you start watching, you keep watching. But they have the show Hemlock Grove, which has done a lot less well because it's really, it's a horror show. You know, they can market it to people that like horror stuff, but it's not a good show. So, you know, you watch one or two and you're not going to keep going.
Willa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Willa Paskin, TV critic for Slate.com.
And coming up next, we're talking to the director of the Center for Bioethics about the trend of U.S. pharmaceutical companies testing drugs in foreign countries. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Over the last couple of decades, there's been a big increase, about 2,000%, in the number of foreign trials of U.S. drugs, according to PBS.
In 2008, 80% of drug applications to the FDA included testing abroad.
Here with us to talk about this is Arthur Kaplan. He's director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Art, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? Although I'm not there anymore. I actually moved.
Oh, you moved from Pennsylvania.
New York University, yeah.
NYU.
About 6 months ago, yep.
Okay, well, congratulations on the move.
Thank you.
And why...
I'm outsourcing myself, just like these clinical trials, I guess.
Yeah, and so you had reasons for your move. What are the reasons for these pharmaceutical companies going to other countries to test their drugs?
The real reasons fall into three categories. First, it's cheaper. You can do this work in India or China or Vietnam for less cost, that just the overhead cost of doing research studies is much less than trying to do them in the U.S. Secondly, some of the companies want to be in China, India to sell their drugs. And if you do the studies there, you can submit your data there and get a little quicker entry, if you will, to these big emerging markets, be it Brazil or Indonesia, wherever. Third, there are a lot of people in these countries that may have diseases, diabetes or asthma, but they've never been treated. They're not taking medicines. They're not getting very good health care. They provide a better research base than trying to study, let's say, asthma in Madison, where, you know, 85% of the people have an inhaler and they're maybe getting some medication, and you're trying to see how well your drug works. You've got to compare it to people who are using other things. You take that study of Vietnam and maybe nobody's got anything else. You can move faster.
So in a sense, someone in the country being studied in might view this as a benefit, a blessing, that they're getting access to a drug that they never would have had access to?
Many do. One of the ethics problems is they do have access in the study, but when the study ends, it's often the case that that's the end of the affordable access. So, yeah, I think people say, hey, this is great. I can sign up and get that inhaler or see somebody who's getting a new diabetes medicine or whatever it might be. But there's a bad news at the end of the tunnel. They're not necessarily going to have affordably priced access to what was being tested on them.
Now, let's compare regulations. Is this industry more tightly regulated in a place like the United States than in China, India, and the other countries we're talking about?
Yeah, that's a big question. So the rules of how to do research pretty much agreed upon around the world. You ought to get informed consent from the person that you want to study something on. You ought to have the research reviewed by a committee of experts to make sure it's scientifically sound. And people ought to look at the consent forms on this committee to make sure they're understandable. But the committee expertise, if you're doing a study in a very poor country in Africa, is not necessarily as good as it would be if you were doing it in Milwaukee or doing it in New York City. If you also say, well, we got to get informed consent, you show up in a very poor country in sub-Saharan Africa and say, I've got a new malaria pill to study. Most people are going to sign up for almost anything. It's not that you aren't getting their consent, but if you will, their poverty, their desperation, may lead them to just jump into a study in a way that a more sophisticated and privileged person in Europe or the U.S. would not.
And then does that in turn put people, the people who have come forward as test subjects, at some kind of risk that that we might not take here in the United States?
It can. For one thing, you might be willing to tolerate a riskier pill, a riskier vaccine, if you got nothing, as opposed to if you had something. So we have a flu vaccine. I think everybody should get it, but it isn't the best vaccine. It doesn't always work year to year. There are definitely studies going on of better flu vaccines, or hope to be better, but they are, their side effects or their risks aren't fully understood. It's probably harder to get somebody here to say, I'll try that new one as opposed to the old one, even though the old one isn't that great, than it would be to administer it in India for a group of people who have nothing. The other problem is when somebody shows up in a white coat with a very poor population, they're almost, it's hard to convince them that they're doing research. They want to believe they've come to treat you and give you therapy and help. The whole concept of studying something and having a placebo trial where you might not get something even though you're in the study, that's hard to convey to people who aren't used to hearing about research.
Now, I want to talk about the end result of drugs researched in this way. I mean, on one hand, people are people. But on the other hand, if we're testing a drug in another country with different diet, different health conditions, maybe different local microbiology populations, does a drug tested over there work the same for us over here?
Another great question. So you can test drugs, let's say, in a very poor community in Vietnam. Are they biologically, genetically the same as the people who are going to get the drugs here in a way that makes a difference or not? We often don't know. We don't think so. Most people say a human is a human, but there are genetic differences, and people do respond differently to drugs. We're only now having to address that question because it's only for a few years that we've really seen this huge move to outsource to other places. In terms of diet and lifestyle, you know, again, very difficult to say whether a drug that's effective in a place where people don't have obesity or diabetes at the same rates, how's that going to work if it's given to relatively young people in a country but used mainly in an older population? Those are all real challenges to outsourcing research. And while the companies can sort of submit the data and the FDA and the regulators don't yell at them for the kind of things we're talking about, I think we're going to see some issues emerge about drug safety or efficacy because of these very differences.
Is this one of those cases where the technology is running out there and this outsourcing practice is running out there and governments and the international health community is kind of trying to play catch up?
I'm going to say yes to that one. I think the shift by private sponsors, particularly drug companies, to study things overseas away from Europe and the U.S. has been pretty abrupt. It may not seem abrupt if it's taken 5-10 years, but that's pretty abrupt by research at the standards, clinical research standards. We have these issues about the comparability of populations. A lot of these countries don't have trained people to kind of even identify adverse events or problems the drugs might cause in the same way. You're operating in some poor places. So has the regulation, including the training of people, do you get informed consent in the poor population, so on, kept up? I don't think it has. We've really got to pay attention to that. Otherwise, the charge is going to come flying out that we're just exploiting people overseas, particularly poor people, studying them like test subjects and then not making anything available, and it's just for our benefit, so to speak.
Well, and that one of the things that led us to want to do this was a report last month after Peru, I gather, loosened up some restrictions some years back. There were over 20,000 Peruvians suddenly getting involved in these pharmaceutical tests. The reports we saw, there was some outrage, talking about just what you were talking about, people getting the sense that the first world was out exploiting the third world. How do you weigh the ethics when you hear those kind of complaints?
So for me, I think any study has to make a commitment to make sure that if something's positive and works, that access will be granted to the study subjects for a significant period of time. Either the sponsor is going to give it away, or you're going to make sure they're going to sell it in that country for an affordable price. And that may mean taking a loss, but I think that's the only way you can evade the charge that you're exploiting people if you study something in Peru, but then the drug is only available for the same condition in the U.S. For other things, you may want to study something and sell it in the country, preventing malaria, which happily we don't have much of except for tourists. Then I think you have to work out an arrangement with the local government to say, you're going to cover this, you're going to make it available, or what? So I call that the what are we leaving behind problem, and I think you've got to make a commitment to do it. Do drug companies always do that now? No.
Well, where does that impetus come from? Is it a voluntary thing that drug companies do? Is it something that, say, the United States government could do for businesses that do business here? Or is this international law? Sounds complicated.
No international law yet. We could push in that direction, and that's that catch-up part of the regulation you were talking about. Right now, to tell you the truth, honestly, it's a little bit of ethical yelling at the sponsors, say. You should design your trials keeping in mind what's going to happen when the study ends, what kind of access you're going to give if the thing works, and really pointing the finger, shaming them in the media, that sort of thing. That's where we're at right now.
And then when it comes right down to it, we do need this research, right, if we're going to have new drugs to treat all manner of diseases.
Absolutely, and there's nothing wrong with developing drugs, to get them into India and China. However, I think where the moral question becomes is, are we only studying drugs that are going to benefit us in poor places? Don't we have some obligation also to study their diseases as well, even if they're not quite as lucrative? That's the bigger justice question. But we do need the research. One way or the other, we do.
Art, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure.
That's Arthur Kaplan. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. Thanks to him for joining us today.
Next is the news, and then we'll find out why our next guest chooses Darth Vader over Luke Skywalker.
I'm looking forward to this discussion. I love talking about villains and bad guys. Comics, movies, TV, you name it. Do you want to hit me with a quick favorite villain as a tease, Veronica?
Oh, for me?
For you.
Favorite villain? I don't know. I have to think about it. What about you? I have a feeling you know one already.
I was thinking as I asked you the question, I'm thinking maybe Richard III as represented by Shakespeare.
Yeah, I was going to say Richard III. You kind of got to like him, don't
hard
you?
Hard to go wrong.
At least he's interesting.
All right, well, we'll find out some more favorite villains and maybe some of yours coming up.
And don't forget, you can keep in step with us on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe leave your favorite villain there as well. And find out what's coming up. Leave your thoughts. That's the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.